Matthew Nix with Nix Companies. Thanks for joining today on the Irregardless podcast. So Nix Companies, as we were just discussing, you guys are in Poseyville, Illinois. Tell me a little bit about
Indiana.
Indiana.
Yeah, we're barely in Indiana, but we're happy to be on the right side of the river. It's a little more business friendly, tax friendly state. I don't think I'll offend too many people in the audience by saying that. It's a matter of fact, anyways.
Well, I don't think you are. But tell me about Nix Companies.
Yeah, so Nix Companies is a family holding company that I formed back in 2017. Our legacy business, which we go by Nix Industrial now, it was a blacksmith shop. My great-great-grandfather started it in the late 1800s, evolved into a mom-and-pop welding shop. We were referred to as Nix Welding. And then when I joined the business, fifth generation, somewhere along the lines, I rebranded to Nix Metals. That sort of better encompassed what we do. And then we subsequently rebranded to Nix Industrial. It's sort of just got a little more broad, you know, as we've gone. But the core business is really still the same. I tell people we make and repair things that are made out of metal. And that's what my great-great-grandfather did in the late 1800s. And it's what we still do today. We deploy different technology to do that. And the customer base that we serve is a little bit different. Although agriculture, which was our predominant customer base back in the day, is still part of our business today. And in fact, we do more for the ag industry than we ever have, but it makes up a much smaller piece of the business today. Primarily, we're a heavy industrial, commercial and heavy industrial business today.
Well, I was reading an article that you were interviewed, and I don't remember exactly who was interviewing you, but you had probably a quote or better quotes I've heard in a while, which is about how you guys have defied the odds for generations, where if you're not growing, you're dying.
Right.
And you managed concurrently to both not grow and not die.
Yeah. Well, they
tell
did
me
that.
About that.
Well, they did that for four generations. So I hope that the irony doesn't totally come back to bite me, which is that we've grown the shit out of it in my generation. So hopefully we're not the ones to kill it too. But for four generations, yeah, it stayed mom and pop. Never had a single employee on the payroll outside the family. It was the brothers owned it in Gen 1, and then the oldest brother bought the older brothers out, which is kind of interesting. Even though I'm Gen 5, there's actually been an extra transition in there. Then my great-grandfather took over, and then my grandfather took over. He was the only boy in the family. And then my dad took over for my grandfather. And it was when I joined the business, it was my dad, my grandpa, and my aunt. And not only did my aunt do the books in the office, she also ran a lathe and a milling machine. You know, everybody just pitched in and did what they had to do. And so I grew up in that business. And so I like to say they were defying the odds. You know, they didn't grow and they didn't die. And they were quite prosperous too. I mean, it was a, very typical kind of working class mom and pop shop. You know, I mean, I grew up with that's how my dad provided for our family. And, we had a great middle-class lifestyle, and he worked his butt off to do that. And my brother and I took over the business, and we've grown it exponentially since then. And hopefully, you know, we can set the next generation up to be successful as well.
So would you say there's a bit of a rebirthing?
Yeah, it was. They were not entrepreneurial, and they didn't have aspirations to grow. And I think, you know, a lot of people have asked me for advice, younger folks or folks starting in business or trying to grow their business. And I say, look, there's nothing wrong with staying small and making really good money. I mean, if you're going to grow, you better put both feet in, and you can't like tiptoe. I'm talking about really intentional growth. I don't mean just the business is going to sort of naturally grow, I think, if you just do good work and, you know, take care of your customers. But I'm talking about intentional growth. You got to decide if that's what you want. And there's nothing wrong with staying small and work, you know, just sort of being your own boss. But I realized somewhere along the way that after a lot of soul searching, like, this is sort of the way God made me, and I can't help it. I'm entrepreneurial. I'm restless. I'm always, you know, just trying to, challenge the status quo. And so
embrace it. Yeah.
Yeah. It took me a while though to embrace that, you know, and my dad asked me one time, when's enough enough? And I really thought about that. You know, I thought, I don't know. I thought as long as I'm healthy and I feel good and my family's healthy, got a good team around me, like it almost feels wrong to not, you know, pursue it.
Perhaps that's not how you think about it at all, by the way, which is one's enough enough. It's like, that's not perhaps what this is even about.
Right. That's what I mean.
This is a personality type, and what you described it resonated to a degree, which is, you know, there's a restlessness and just a desire to be entrepreneurial or industrious. And it's not really thought about in a measure of have I achieved what I set out to do? It's about doing.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Are we better than we were last year? And you know, it's a tremendous opportunity, I think, too. And that really motivates me, the opportunity to do good and to make an impact in people's lives, in our community, in our industry, if I'm going to be really audacious. So we just keep going.
An interesting thing happened with your generation, which is, and I correct me when I'm just completely wrong, but you were a mom and pop, and it sounds like you took some license as you were coming of age in your 20s to put numbers on the side of trucks and other things. But, you know, that's one thing to have kind of the understanding to, okay, let's do some marketing. Another thing to be like, okay, let's form a holding company that acquires other companies and be not quite a family office, but not quite private equity. And that brings a level of sophistication into the arena that sounds like, the sophistication, probably the capability was there, but you guys were not thinking in that direction. And what sort of kicked off your thinking? Those are things that you just don't stumble into. Was there advising that was going on? How did you come into this kind of this growth path?
Yeah, great question. Well, you know, I think to some extent I did stumble into it, but I did so by being really open-minded and really, being open about what opportunities are out there. So we had acquired one business, much like a lot of people do, in a very opportunistic way. So the business was in our town. It was closely adjacent to what we did. And I thought it was a good real estate play. So we bought the business. So I had one acquisition under my belt. It was small. There was 5 team members that came over with us and worked through a lot of challenges in that process. It didn't all go like we expected and wanted it to, but I think working through those challenges and coming out the other side and making it a success gave me even more confidence that, you know, we can do this. And then around the same time, I'm in a business owner peer group. It's a grassroots, cross-functional group of people. None of us are in the same industry, and been doing that for 11 years now. It's been really impactful for my career, but also just developed lifelong friendships, deep, meaningful friendships in the process. But one of the gentlemen in my group runs a real estate and auction company. And he was saying this years ago. It's common language now, but this is, you know, a decade or so ago. He said, our world is about to see the largest exchange of wealth that we've ever seen as the baby boomers go into, you know, retirement. All of these businesses and all this wealth, in his case, farmland specifically, he's in the auction business, but other assets too, they all have to, you know, move hands from one generation to the next. The largest exchange of wealth in the history of our country. And I started thinking about that, and I thought, wow, this guy's sitting right in front of this wave. What a great spot to be. And you know, how might I position myself sort of in a similar position? And you know, similar to what you were saying earlier, like my motivation's never really been financially driven. I just saw this as like a smart thing to do. If there's going to be this wave and this transfer, positioning oneself in front of that seems like a good place to be. A lot more opportunity. And so I'd done one acquisition and I started thinking, well, what if we bought other businesses like ours? And lo and behold, there's a tremendous amount of businesses out there, many of which are owner operator, often don't have succession plans, or if they do, you know, maybe the plans didn't work out. And so we acquired our first fab shop. It was a structural fabrication business, very closely, you know, related to what we did. And from then we learned a little bit more, and we acquired a heavy machine shop, and we learned a little bit more, and we acquired another one. And we've come to realize that we do have something unique, and that is that, like, what we do at these businesses is really not unique at all, in the sense that we do the same thing every other shop does in the country. You know, we make and repair parts out of metal. We all generally buy the same equipment. You know, we're all trying to do the same things. We're trying to implement lean and be efficient and so on and so forth. What I figured out that was unique was that we could deploy some economies of scale and some shared service and some synergies by creating this small home office. And, you know, most of these shops aren't large enough to have a full-time CFO or a full-time HR or a full-time safety manager, or, you know, add to the list. You get the point. And we can deploy that from a home office and share these services across all these businesses, and it brings our overhead structure down. But really, we're able to bring world-class, I think, administrative support, sophistication to these businesses, and really let them do what they do well, and we sort of supplement. And, you know, we've had our share of challenges, but by and large, it's worked.
Yeah, I think I was kind of laughing internally, being from Indiana, and your quarterback Mendoza talking about synergies a lot recently. I don't know if you caught those interviews. And they're like, they asked him, they said, what is, you keep saying that word. He's like, I don't even know what it means. It just sounds right for, because it sounds right for a team. I was like, yeah, that made him instantly likable when he's like, oh, I don't know what it means. But, okay, so you guys are acquire adjacent and be able to, you know, roll up or share costs and resources across, I guess, the different silos that you guys have internally. So winding the clock back, I thought you guys done a great job of chronicling the family story, fifth generation. You had that newspaper clipping that was on your website of Carl at 8 years old. working at the blacksmith shop. So what do you guys, do you know what you guys were actually making back in the 1800s? I mean, we talking like shoes for horses kind of thing, or
absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I have firsthand record from my grandfather, who was born in, the late 20s, I think. Anyways, he, you know, we firsthand accounts from him. So he certainly still remembers the blacksmith shop quite vividly. He's since passed away, but we were very blessed to be able to get him on camera and share some things. But, and we still have a lot of the old equipment too. We've got a little metalworking museum in our foyer at our main office. But yeah, they were shoeing horses. He talked about making little hooks for fences and things for agriculture. And, you know, yeah, it was just a lot of little metal parts that the farmers and ranchers needed. And that, of course, evolved. And, you know, even when I was growing up, we would weld up a lot of plow points, build them up. They get wore down from going through the field. And that's how I learned to weld, because you couldn't really screw it up. You just run pass after pass after pass and then lay some hard surfacing on it. And, you know, we built fuel tanks for farmers, you know, welded up dump trucks and farm equipment and mangled up corn planters where they hit a telephone pole or something. I mean, you name it, we did.
And were you guys farming at all, or you were sort of the kind of like the guys selling the, more like selling the shovels out at the gold mine, you know?
well, wasn't quite that good, but no, we didn't farm. We do have a little bit of farm ground that we rent out, but no, we've never farmed. We're too busy working on the farm equipment.
And so, you know, fifth generation, that's not a common tale, honestly. It's usually third generation. If the company's been around for three generations, usually it's facing maybe a disposition by Gen 3. Yeah. It seems to be kind of the common tale. But as you were growing up, were you thinking that you were going to be at Nick's, or did you have other plans?
Yeah, I really did. One thing I considered was an architect. It's the only other thing I remember, like, legitimately considering, which I think is interesting, because now, like, the things I'm drawn to, and I kind of consider myself an architect in a sense of, you know, architecting the vision and the organizational structure of the business. The only other thing I considered, I went to Vincennes University for a year. It's a popular 2-year school around here. It has a really great welding program. And a lot of folks would leave there and go to Purdue and get their 4-year. And I considered metallurgical engineering. I thought that seemed interesting. And then I just decided I didn't want to go to school anymore. And I was ready to get back and get to work. So I went for 1 year for welding and then went right back to work. But yeah, other than that, I pretty much felt like the family business was where I was going to end up. And that differs from my brother's path. He went, got a 4-year degree, really was not interested in the business at all. He shares, he even had some disdain for it at times, but he came full circle, and I'm glad he did. He's a tremendous partner, and he and I make a good team. And my wife's involved as well. She quit her job. She went to IU for 4 years and quit her job and has worked on the administrative side of our business and really been instrumental in helping us grow as well.
And circling back to something you commented on earlier, which is it sounds like mentorship is in kind of your world. You said you're talking to people who are starting out or maybe just had an ambition to go do something. Your journey's probably informed your thinking quite a bit there. And what are maybe the top three things you would say to a young buck who's thinking about going out and starting their own business or trying to, you know, chase down a dream? What are the three things that you would advise them?
That's a good question. That's a tough one. But before I answer that, let me just say that I have had so many tremendous mentors along the way, so many people that have poured into me. And I think largely that's because I've sought it out. So that maybe that might be the first thing I would say is, like, you know, be curious and don't be afraid to seek out, you know, input or advice from others. I'll never forget. I had a lunch one time. There's only one family business in the Evansville area. That's the largest, you know, kind of metro to us here. There's only one family business in town that's $1 billion a year business. And so, you know, by most measures, they're maybe the most successful family business. They've also been around 5 generations. And I asked the CEO to go to lunch with me. We were a tiny blip on the radar back then. And he took me up on it. And I asked him at the lunch, I said, you know, why did you agree to do this? You don't really know me from Adam. And he said, well, it's pretty simple, Matthew. He said, you asked, you know, and it was like, what I think was implied there is not that many people ask him to go to lunch. And so there was a huge lesson in that for me. And I've since had a lot of very successful folks, you know, that I've been able to engage with in that way. We formed an advisory board that's been instrumental as well. So first thing would probably be curious. Don't be afraid to reach out and ask for input. The next thing I would say is you've got to really have a clear vision of where you want to go. If you're not crystal clear about where you want to go, then others can't be clear about that. And if you're not clear about it, you're not going to believe in it, and others aren't going to believe in it. So you got to be really, you got to have a really clear vision. My dad used to always say when we were fixing broken farm equipment, he would say, if you can't see the end of the project before you start, you're effed. You can fill in the blank. He talked like a typical rough guy in a welding shop. But, you know, that really stuck with me. And it's relevant if you're fixing something that's broken, and it's relevant if you're building a business. You got to be able to see the future and what are the stepping stones to get there. And then the third thing, that sounds really cliche, but I'm going to tell you, nothing maybe matters more, is you got to surround yourself with the right people. And, you know, I've been very fortunate to be able to do that. And I think that compelling vision, well, I don't think, I know that compelling vision is instrumental in that. The more clear and compelling your vision is, the higher likelihood you're going to be able to bring really great people in around you to support that vision. So I guess off the cuff, those are three things I would say.
I would echo every one of those. I think assembling the mentorship is paramount.
Yeah.
And it's when you're younger and you're talking to these guys, I would add to it, just have a measure of humility, because you are not going to be able to see what they see. I mean, they've seen so much because, you know, they've been in business 20 years longer, and they say things, and when you're younger, you're just like, you're thinking like, it's amazing how much these guys don't know. And then like 6 months later, exactly what they told you was going to happen happens.
Yeah.
And you're like, holy shit.
I remember a specific example of that. We were growing like a rocket ship, and one of them said, "How's your cash flow?" And I thought, "Cash flow? What the hell is he talking about? I mean, it's fine, I guess. We're growing.
Strong.
Everything's fine." And I'll be damned if it wasn't. Yeah, like you said, I don't know. A year or so later, it was like we had a cash flow crunch, and we had been having record year after record year, but he saw what was coming that I didn't see. You know, the CapEx keeps getting bigger and bigger, and the accounts receivable keeps getting bigger and bigger, and all of a sudden a big customer doesn't pay on time, and this perfect storm sort of happens. I had a massive tax bill that we had to pay because we had a record year, and it was like,
knocks the wind out of you.
Oh yeah. And all of a sudden you have a cash crunch, and it was like, yeah, I remember him just plain as day saying, "How's your cash flow? You know what? Keep an eye on that. You know, cash is king." And so that's always stuck with me.
Oh, it's so true. I mean, just having that mentorship, and I think the humility is, I think always at every step of a journey is the right thing. But I mean, not foolishly humble, meaning like maintain good level of confidence. Yeah. Once a decision's made.
A simple way of expressing humility in those settings is taking notes. Like you said, not false humility, just this acknowledgement that, like, hey, you know a lot, and I asked you for a reason, and I'm here to listen, and taking notes. I think the two most important things that make mentors want to continue to engage with you, this has just been my own observation, is taking notes, and so that they know you're really listening and you care. Maybe even share, like, here were my takeaways. Hey, thanks for your time. Here were my key takeaways. But then having them share in your success along the way. I think that really makes them feel like they were a part of the journey and they want to continue to engage with you. So it might be a year later, we have a big milestone and you reach out and say, hey, just want to share with you. You know, we talked a year ago. I did a couple things and here's a great outcome that's come out of that. And I think that, you know, I've had the CEO of a $7 billion company. He took it public, just massively successful CEO. He's came back and spoke to our company at our annual meeting 3 times now. The collective amount I've paid him is 3 cups of coffee. He's done that because he's been a part of the journey now, you know, and he keeps coming back. So anyways, for what it's worth, I think that's hugely important if you want to continue to engage with mentors.
And so what do you see is, you know, you've probably talked about this many times, but I think it's becoming more and more, it's becoming less of a toy, which is AI. And I think that, you know, you have a family of companies and a lot going out, and you're out in the market, presumably, you know, maybe actively or sort of passively looking for acquisition targets, or what's next best steps for you guys. How are you thinking about AI?
We're deploying it a lot. We're thinking about it a lot. I'll admit I have not been really deploying it in search of acquisitions. That's largely probably just because we haven't been really actively pursuing deals at the moment. We're still digesting a couple right now, and we're taking inbound opportunities, but, you know, I'm not out there driving. But I'll say this about AI. This is on my mind because I had a one-on-one debrief shortly before our call here today. And something I've started asking, trying to ask, if I can remember to be disciplined about this, in all my debriefs, and one of the things I'm ending the call with is, tell me about a few ways that you've used AI in the last couple of weeks. Two reasons I'm asking that question. One, I'm trying to send the signal that this is important and we're trying to remind everybody, but also I'm almost always learning something that somebody on my team is doing that I haven't thought about yet, or I can share with other people on our team. You know, and so we've really taken the approach of trying to encourage people to leverage this technology, and our VP of administration is set himself a weekly reminder where he's sending out an email communicating to our team. So he's either sharing best practices from within the company or outside the company or an article. We're just trying to encourage right now and then sort of shine the light on when someone has used it to really drive some efficiencies or think outside the box. But I mean, we're probably using it in a lot of the same ways most people are. I don't know that we need to get into all the details, but I think, you know, maybe I'll just share a light bulb moment when this happened last week. And when I realized I'm not even scratching the surface of what I could be doing, my 11-year-old came home from school. He had about an hour and a half before he was going to go to wrestling practice. And he was over playing around on his computer. And I thought maybe he was doing homework. And I walked by and said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm making my own video game." I said, "What do you mean you're making your own video game?" He said, "Yeah, I'm using AI and it's telling him what I want. And it's writing the code and it's going back and forth." And he got far enough. He left for practice and he came back from practice. And then before bedtime, he was playing the damn video game that existed in his imagination 4 hours earlier. And that was like head explosion for me. I was like, okay, we've got to be doing so much more than this. So,
well, yeah, it's a bit of a paradox, right? Which is, I was just reading an article. I think it was in, I think it might have been the Harvard Business Review or something like that, that was talking about the paradox of employers asking employees to use AI, right? Which is, on the one hand, the employee says, yes, I should use that because that will make me more efficient, which will make me have more value to this business.
Yeah.
And when we all do better, we all do better. The other side of that being, of course, if we get too good at this and I start writing and making autonomous programs for my functions here, maybe I am not going to be needed as much as I was before. And it's explored kind of the paradox of it, which is, as companies push out AI and do things, that it gives people pause of like, I don't know if I really want to use this.
You know, that has never occurred to me until you just said that. And I think, well, first of all, it's perfectly rational why people would think that. I think there's a couple reasons why that has never occurred to me. And I feel quite confident in saying that doesn't go through my team members' minds. There's two reasons. We have such a culture of growth and innovation, and I think it's been so instilled in them before AI and during AI that they already like have this predisposition that if we get faster, we're just going to do more. Perhaps we'll slow down the rate that we add people, but the idea of minimizing people, that doesn't even go through their mind, nor does it go through mine. The second one is the industry we're in. So I would say if you're in customer service in an insurance company, yeah, you might need to be a little worried about AI, you know, automating that. But if you're doing highly engineered products like we are, you know, or, you know, anything in our world, I think it's going to make us much more efficient. But automating what we do without still a lot of human intervention feels like that's a long way away. And yeah, we don't even know conceptually what that even looks like. So anyways.
No, I hear you. And I think that is, so that article did not explore the concept of, given a certain team composition, there is sort of this, well, if I'm successful with AI, then I'm out of here. They're not going to need me anymore. Whereas if you got the right team, it's like, no, I'm glad you don't have to do that stuff anymore. Let's go get this stuff now.
Yep. Yep. How can we add more value?
Yeah. If we can cover more ground.
Yep.
That's a good thing. So anyway, tell me more about so you have the companies that you're making, you have is it just Nick's Industries or Industrial that is the direct lineage of the original Nick's? And yep. what do you guys do? I want to hear a little bit about that.
Sure. Yes. Yes. Nick's Industrial is the direct lineage from the blacksmith shop. And we've done multiple acquisitions under that. That's a true, you know, sort of roll up strategy, you know, nothing new there. They keep their operational presence. We slowly rebrand them over to Nick's Industrial. We centralize a lot of the back office, but the estimating stays localized. We're really big on decentralization. So we want to have as much autonomy of those locations as possible. So within that, we have a series of businesses that all sort of specialize. So the legacy business, which is the direct lineage, is one location underneath that. And it's a heavy equipment repair business. So we fix semi-trailers, dump trucks, garbage trucks, farm equipment, bulldozers, excavators, you get the idea, heavy industrial equipment, and a lot of stuff out of plants too, power plants, and so on and so forth. Big, heavy, dirty stuff made out of metal. We fix it, weld it, machine it, cut it apart, put it back together, that kind of thing. So that's the legacy business. We've got a field coatings business. We go out in the field and sandblast and paint out in the field. A lot of crossover with the customer base there. Oftentimes the metal guys and the paint guys will be working, you know, on the same project. We have a custom fabrication shop, pretty traditional custom shop, I would say. You know, we're building a lot of platforms, catwalks, guarding, rails. It's plant work. We have an engineering team. We go in alongside the customer, design a solution. They're saying, hey, I need to get up there and work on that piece of equipment. Help me do it efficiently, safely, so on and so forth. So that's that business. We have a paint and powder coat shop. That shop supports a lot of our other shops. We acquired a structural shop. That's traditional structural fab, so new building construction. It's beams and columns all day long. We have, you know, CNC beam lines. You unload a raw beam on one end of the building and you send a fabricated beam out the other end. So that's all that business does. We've got a machine shop, traditional machine shop, where I'd say about half repair work and about half make new. And then most recently we acquired a sheet metal shop, pretty traditional sheet metal. It's laser cutting, CNC forming, some robotic welding, a lot of manual welding still. So we're a contract manufacturer where we might make 1,000 of this, 2,000 of that kind of thing. So you can see the similarities in all the businesses. They're all adjacent, but they all sort of specialize operationally in what we do. And so, you know, back to the synergy thing. I mean, the practical aspects of that are buying power. They all buy metal for the most part. So we have that. And then the other big one would just be the shared services in the back office. So that's what the business looks like. And those locations are spread across, you know, a few hour radius. So it's all still pretty regionalized.
And then you also have a marketing business or a content business in there as well.
We have a few other businesses outside the core legacy that are all, you know, part of the family holding company. So yeah, the marketing business, the way we got into that was our head of marketing, who's very talented, approached me and said, hey, I've always wanted to start my own business. You know, I'm thinking about starting my own business. Would you be interested in supporting me and helping me do that? And, I always joke and say it wasn't real, selfless of me to help him, that I was going to lose him or help him. So I might as well help him. But it's been great.
Well played.
He's appreciative. I think it's been a great partnership. We've certainly brought a lot of clients to him and we're still his biggest client. Although he's growing so well, so fast that I've got to kind of try to keep my spot in line with him, but he's got a team of three now and he does all our video content and, you know, he does, other traditional marketing as well. But so that's one of them. We also bought a heavy truck body shop. So that's outside the legacy business. But again, the similarities is this blue collar service work. So the economics are similar. The common denominator is, can you attract great blue collar talent, you know, skilled trades talent. That's kind of the common denominator in the businesses we have. So we fix wreck semis, city buses, Amazon vans, UPS, so on and so forth. And then we also bought a truck equipment upfitter. And we're actually merging those two businesses together under a new brand called Fleet Service Partners. So that'll be a sister to Nick's Industrial. And we hope to continue to do acquisitions under that platform as well. So that would be like we build, big, heavy work trucks, you know, think like lube trucks, city trucks for salt spreaders and snow plows and so forth, things of that nature.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you guys have got your hands full with all of this. And looking ahead is kind of, without getting into too much of what is your business, but is just to continue on the same trajectory, basically, of like building out the right groupings of businesses and kind of just proceed.
Yeah, I say just rinse and repeat. You know, it's just, we just need to keep doing what we're doing, do it well. Not everything we do works perfectly. So, you know, we just learn as we go. And if we make a mistake, let's get it corrected. But by and large, you know, from a macro standpoint, it's working. So let's keep doing what we're doing and rinse and repeat.
Well, good. Well, I want to keep us to right about where we are now, about 45 minutes or so, but wanted to say, you know, thank you for coming on today. I've enjoyed learning about your business and about what you guys are doing. I love the five generations. You just don't hear that very often. And you guys have done such a good job of curating, chronicling that, you know, love hearing the stories.
Yeah, thank you for that. Speaking of chronicling, I'll shamelessly plug my book here.
Bring
so,
it.
Yeah, we a really talented writer named Angie Klink. She's a professional historian, professional writer. She wrote this book. And I think the subtitle kind of sums it up. It says, How Five Generations of Small Town Values Collided with Big Ambitions to Spark One of America's Fastest Growing Company. And so if you're listening,
Forging
Ahead. Yeah.
Okay.
That's the title. But it's on Amazon or any of the major bookstores. And
when was that released? When did you guys get that done?
Yeah, November of 24. Yeah, so just a little over a year ago, the book came out. And it tells the story of the early aspects of the story, but then also the recent, you know, part of our journey with the mergers and acquisitions and so forth.
That's fabulous. Well, people need to bring up, go get Forging Ahead.
Yeah, thank you.
And take a read on it. But I want to say thank you again. It's been fun chatting with you, and hope to talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on.
All right, have a good one.